Our reading today comes from the writer and author Alain de Botton's 2016 essay entitled, Why You Will Marry the Wrong Person. Married couples, you can just look straight ahead. It's one of those things we are most afraid might happen to us. We go to great lengths to avoid it, and yet we all do it the same. We marry the wrong person. Partly it's because we have a bewilderingly array of problems that emerge when we try to get close to others. We seem normal only to those who don't know us very well. In a wiser, more self-aware society than ours, a standard question on an early dinner date would be, "And how are you crazy?" The problem is that before marriage, we rarely delve into our complexities. Whenever casual relationships threaten to reveal our flaws, we blame our partners and call it a day. As for our friends, they don't care enough to do the hard work of enlightening us. One of the privileges of being on our own is therefore the sincere impression that we are really quite easy to live with. Our partners are no more self-aware. Naturally, we make a stab at trying to understand them. We visit their families, we look at their photos, we meet their college friends. All of this contributes to a sense that we've done our homework. We haven't. Marriage ends up as a hopeful, generous, infinitely kind gamble taken by two people who don't know yet who they are or who they might be, binding themselves to a future they cannot conceive of and having carefully avoided investigating. The good news is that it doesn't matter if we marry the wrong person. We mustn't abandon them, but only the idea that a perfect being exists who can meet all our needs and satisfy our every yearnings. We need to swap this view for a tragic, and at points comedic, awareness that every human will frustrate, anger, annoy, madden, and disappoint us, and we will, without any malice, do the same. But none of this is unusual or grounds for divorce. Choosing whom to commit ourselves is merely a case of identifying which particular variety of suffering we would most like to sacrifice ourselves for. The person who is best suited to us is not the person who shares our every taste, but the person who can negotiate differences intelligently, the person who is good at disagreement. It is the capacity to tolerate differences with generosity that is the true marker of the not overly wrong person. Compatibility is an achievement of love. It must not be its precondition.
Just as an interesting side note, that article that Sean just read, I found out the most read article on the New York Times in 2016. Which, I mean, if you think about 2016 and the news that was going around at that time, that's kind of amazing. Says something about the state of marriages that year, I'd imagine. So there was a moment last Sunday when Sean came out for the announcement of the results of the vote. That is the vote that represents the unique right of congregations in our tradition to call their own ministers. So as he came out this moment, the congregation rose to cheer as we announced the results that he had indeed been called. The whole place was filled with joy and elation and also a kind of relief. Relief for many reasons, I'd imagine, but especially because it indicated something important. Something represented by a word that we use to talk about ministers once we are called. We say we are settled ministers, as in not going anywhere. Now, in my rational mind, I, to be honest, haven't been all that worried about Sean going anywhere. But the less rational parts in that moment felt the relief too. The relief that we could be set, settled, for a time even, that we could breathe a little, rest, go on sabbatical, perhaps. It took so long to get here. We had weathered so much in the past 5 years. To feel this kind of stability felt like a kind of achievement, an end. But then in that same moment, I felt in myself like the visceral memory of my own call. I've had two moments like that, actually, that we had last Sunday, two votes here in this congregation. Some of us that have been called from within the congregation, we joke about what it feels like to be voted on by your own congregation. It's a unique experience. I've had it twice. I remembered in my body as I saw Sean standing here looking out at many of you. I remembered first my call as associate 5 years ago, almost exactly. Mark Salkin would be retiring a few months later, after more than two decades as the settled senior minister. After the vote, people told me, with a similar joy as we experienced last Sunday, a similar relief, how much they appreciated that I'd keep things stable and settled through Mark's retirement. Now, those of you who were here during that time, or who just recognized it in the laughter, know that the period that came next was many things, but stable or settled, not so much. Which is why in the fall of 2015, when the congregation voted again, this time for my call to senior minister, the relief and joy was even more profound. I had people tell me afterwards that they were so glad they knew I would now be here to do their memorial. Which is, it's actually not that unusual. I know it seems strange for those of you not in ministry, but actually it's something people say when they feel a connection to a minister. It's just that in this case, it was people in their 50s. Like early 50s. But we had worked so hard to get to that point. I mean, we're all feeling that relief. To be able to count on a kind of predictability, to say that we'd made it, that we could indeed breathe. Little did we know what would happen in 2016, or 2017, or 2018. Little did we know what would happen in our country over these years, in our culture, and in our congregation. We have not yet, it turns out, experienced a time that I would call settled. Now, because of these experiences in my mind as I was thinking about this service, I decided to choose for the front of the program and the image, this image of whitewater rafting. And in particular, this moment, you can see there's that guy on the back, you can sort of see on that he's, in my mind, when I thought about this image, I thought, this guy's about to fall off. And so I was thinking, after a time of whitewater, and maybe where somebody even falls off, then what comes next after this time? Okay, so because I was had in my mind this kind of instability and this long-term relationship. Well, then I was talking to Kristen Saki about whitewater rafting in this image, and she'd written this article, maybe some of you read about being in the stream, the river of ministry with all of you. And I said, yes, and then you end up in whitewater and one of you falls off. And she says, actually, that moment in whitewater rafting, that guy is actually steering. All right, this is the limits of my knowledge about whitewater rafting. It turns out, she says, that that moment is actually a representative of the reason that people go whitewater rafting. It's actually a moment of joy. In his book, The Course of Love, Alain de Botton, who wrote that piece that Sean read, reflects on the moments in relationships where we officially decide that we're in, those moments of commitment, moments like that vote to call a minister. He's talking, though, about romantic relationships. But I think it applies in relationships of all sorts. The ways that we think about love in our culture, which is that we confuse these early moments, these starts, as the culmination of love itself. The stories that we tell and internalize are all about the moment, about the work that it takes to get to these moments, this yes, so that once there is commitment, everything else is, well, happily ever after, stable, settled. As he says in so many love stories, there is simply nothing else for the narrator to do with a couple after they have triumphed over a range of initial obstacles other than to consign them to an ill-defined future or kill them off. We seem to know, he says, far too much about how love starts and recklessly little about how it will continue. The real work of love, after all, is not in the falling, but in the continuing. The real work of love is in that what comes next. It was late 2014 when I got an email from some church members. Late 2014 means that it was about 8 months after that first glorious moment of so-called relief and the settling of my first call, and 6 months after Mark's retirement, which I would call his unsettling, pretty much everything in our community and the network of relationships that we represent here felt hard and at risk. We were in that whitewater, and obviously I don't know how to steer. Those of us in leadership had not too long before this moment, we had received another email from another one of our members. The subject line said literally, "This church used to be such a joyful place." Yeah. But this email that I got this one morning, when it came to me, I knew when I read it, I had to go see them, those who had sent this to me, as soon as possible. They were ready to leave. They felt alienated, hurt, for some specific reasons and also from just a generic sense of disorientation. I called and asked if I could come over. They said yes. And before long, we were sitting at their kitchen table talking about our church, where we had been, what they were feeling now, and what would come next. They wondered if maybe they should just take a break. For a while, maybe, at least during this between time, at least until there was a new settled minister. I looked at them as they said this. They were people who I know had made this church over the years. They'd made this community, this human goodness possible for years. My heart, as I looked at them, was filled with gratitude and also anticipatory grief at the idea of their leaving. So I said, "You can do that if you must. There is no coercion in covenant, so it is always a choice that you have. But what I hope you will do instead, what we need you to do instead, is not to leave, but to lean in closer. Come more often, not less. Show up even more with your commitment and your care, your passion, your history, and also your pain. This community needs you now more than ever." And you know what is so amazing? They said, "Okay." every Sunday from then on, pretty much the whole of the next few years they came. And with their help and the help of many others, including many of you, we worked out a way forward through that time of transition, that whitewater, which was to say a time also of grief and a time of joy and rebirth. I mean, just think of all that happened over the course of the last few years, all that has been reborn, the vibrant community gathered here each Sunday, the care that we have sustained, so much new things over these past few years. Those sisterhood groups and their growth have happened all in the past few years. The food bank, the One Village, One Family, the sanctuary vote that we took, that new and emerging immigration work that continues. The real work of love is not actually in the settling, but in the what comes next. 2 Sundays ago, Kristen shared a quote from writer Glennon Doyle. She says, "When you look closely at people, you end up loving them." I appreciate this quote so much because I think what she's saying is that there's always a story behind any given behavior. Always. There's always a need or a value. There's an upbringing, an injury, maybe a hope. It's nearly impossible to disregard someone or to imagine someone as worthy of love once you know their story. So that it is in the leaning in closer, often right as we're wanting to run the other way, that allows us to learn, as Glennon Doyle also says, that there's another option than fight or flight, a third option, to heal. Any of us who have been in close relationships for any sort of sustained amount of time, we know there are endless opportunities to consider all three options: fight, flight, or heal. Because while it is true that as you look at people closely, you tend to love them, it is also true, as Desbottins says, in this closeness, we have a bewildering array of problems that emerge. In any given relationship, there are thousands of ways to misunderstand each other, disappoint each other, break our promises, new and regular opportunities for us to learn about betrayal and loss, new and regular opportunities to find our beloved annoying or simply boring, and sometimes mean, to wonder if perhaps it is no longer true that the gift is in the staying, but instead that the gift would be in the leaving and the letting go. Another thing about writer Glennon Doyle, she of this whole, when you look closely at people, you end up loving them. She wrote a book called Love Warrior. It was about a major what comes next moment. Her husband had confessed to her after many years of marriage that he had been serially unfaithful to her, like since their wedding. And the book is about what comes next after he makes this confession. And ultimately, the book is about the way that they repaired their relationship, committed themselves to each other and loving for the long haul. Which is why it was especially surprising when, right as the book was about to be released to the public, literally the month before it was about to come out, Glennon Doyle announced that she and her husband were separating. Her publishers were not exactly thrilled. I mean, announcing your divorce while trying to sell a book about the power of marriage, not exactly a recipe for success. In her announcement, she describes how she learned with her husband, after all they had been through, that you can be shattered and still put yourself back together, piece by piece. She discovered that third way. Instead of fight or flight, she discovered what it would really mean to heal. But she also discovered that sometimes in the healing and the putting your pieces back together, you realize that you have become a whole new person, a person that no longer fits with the relationship as it was. She decided in the end that she was not called to be successful as her publishers might want, but only faithful. And in this case, she decided that leaving was faithful. One of the realities of long-term community life is that there will be transitions across our relationships. People will leave for all sorts of reasons, and often for reasons we can't totally even name or understand. These moments are often tinged with grief, but what matters most of all in community is how we tend to these transitions, both as the ones who leave and the ones who stay, how we acknowledge them and hold them with care, how we refuse to blame or try to coerce. There is no coercion in covenant. How we stay open even in the parting to this call of healing that is always still available, to keep leaning in to the ongoing work of love. It is never easy to know in these moments when the impulse arises to flee or to stay, which would be the faithful choice, the choice that represents the work of love. There are, however, often clues that help us discern. We can listen for what is behind that impulse, whether we are seeking to control or to surrender, if we are seeing more clearly or refusing to see what is there, if we are driven by fear or by hope. We can listen for where the healing needs to happen, where growth is possible. That is it in the relationship or out of it? Knowing that the only thing that really grows us ever is love and pain. Often the mix of these things together. It is an intensely spiritual choice to learn how to lean in like this, to turn towards rather than turn away from what feels like our limits, to learn to endure in the presence of the real that comes up in ourselves and in the other, to let ourselves feel this much, to not run away from our feelings, to let ourselves feel this much with others, to let our lives matter this much. Reaching our limit, Pema Chodron, the spiritual teacher, says, despite what we have been taught, can be like finding a doorway to the unconditional goodness of humanity rather than meeting an obstacle or a punishment. What happened last Sunday with Sean's call is just like what happens each time someone joins this congregation, just like what happens in marriage ceremonies, in the arrival of children, any of these. They are not insignificant milestones, but also, just as they are a completion of one sort of thing, they are also just the start of another. That is, they are the promise of love, but the real work of love is in what comes next. Which brings me to the envelopes you received on your way in. You knew I would get there eventually. Now, I hope you will take those home and read through all the materials slowly, carefully. Some of the print is kind of small, so if you need larger print, there's some in the office. Most of all, I want to draw your attention to the orange sheet there, where you will find our vision. This vision is the path that we set for ourselves, the promise of love that we intend to make real. This path that we will make real through our willingness to show up fully in this next moment. And the next. And the next. Show up with our open hearts, our curious minds, and with our resources. We are asking this year for everyone to get on a path of giving 5% of your income and get us all on this path to our future. We invite everyone who participates at Foothills to participate, to find your place on this path. 120 years after our founders first imagined it, we are still called to be that church of humanity, to do the work of love long past that first promising, to meet every bewildering and beguiling moment with resilience and a constant faith, discerning together the path of healing and hope, of justice and joy. The power of this community, our possibilities, as with all relationships, has always been in that decision. The decision that we make to offer ourselves as we are, to keep showing up even in struggle and in doubt, in service of this bold vision that is ours, that we might keep growing together, held and called by a courageous, steadfast love. May it be so. Amen.